Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fatal Charm, the Shocking True Story of Serial Wife Killer Randy Roth, by Carlton Smith. Narrated by Keith Sellenwright. The Lake. 1. The Hottest Day of the Year. It had been the hottest day of the year, and as the long afternoon drew on toward evening, the two boys sat on the beach and peered out across the lake, arguing idly. Tyson Baumgartner, 11, thought he could see the rubber raft. His brother, Riley, 9, was certain he couldn't. "I think I see them," Tyson said. "Where?" said Riley, doubting it. The lake was Lake Sammamish, one of the Seattle area's most popular recreation spots, and on a day as hot as July 23, 1991, when the temperature was nearly 100, the water was filled with motorboats churning endlessly up and down, some towing skiers, others heading into or away from shore. With all the waves and the boat traffic, the low-riding small gray inflatable was easy to overlook. "Yep," said Tyson, "that's them. But I don't see Mom." "She's probably lying in the bottom, sunbathing," Riley said. The two brothers watched as the raft picked its way through the boat traffic. A shirtless man in dark glasses was rowing steadily, but not with any particular haste. As the tiny craft neared the roped-off swimming area, the rower turned around so he was facing the beach and began to push the raft in toward the shore with the two plastic oars. It took longer, but the rower didn't seem to mind. The boys saw that the raft was pointed toward the south end of the swimming area. They walked over to meet it as it neared the shore. Yep, it was Randy, all right. "Keep your raft 25 yards away from the swimming area," a lifeguard boomed through a bullhorn, but the man kept on rowing. When the lifeguard called out again, the rower looked up, puzzled, as if to say, "Who, me?" Then the raft reached the beach, and the man in the sunglasses got out and started pulling the craft up on the sand, ignoring the two boys. Tyson and Riley looked down into the well of the raft and saw their mother. She was lying in about 4 inches of water. Her blonde hair hung in wet, unruly, tangled strands across her face. Her eyes were vacant. Her face and upper torso were blue. She wasn't breathing. She lay completely still. She wasn't sunbathing. The man in the sunglasses turned to Tyson and spoke quietly. "Go get the lifeguard," he said. "Ask him for help, but don't make a commotion." There were probably 300 or 400 people on the beach that day, and so ordinary was the landing of the rubber raft, only a few paid any attention. The nearest lifeguard barely gave the raft a glance as it came ashore. Now, as Michael McFadden's eyes habitually scanned the roped-off swimming area for swimmers in trouble, he gave little notice to the two boys calling up to him in his elevated seat. They wanted help with something, but McFadden wasn't sure with what, exactly. "I can't leave the chair right now," McFadden said. "Go up to the lifeguard shack. They can help you there." Then, out of the corner of his eye, McFadden caught a glimpse of something strange about the raft 30 yards away.
88! 88!
McFadden screamed, calling the lifeguard's emergency signal. He jumped down onto the sand and went into a sprint, nearly knocking over a couple of people as he ran. Another lifeguard, hearing McFadden's alarm, raised her megaphone. "Clear the water! Clear the water!" she shouted. The urgency of the shout froze everyone for an instant. Then there was chaos as everyone tried to get out of the water at the same time. McFadden was 19 years old. Lifeguarding was just a summer job, something to earn a bit to help out for college in the fall. Now, as he looked down into the gray inflatable boat, he knew he was going to have to try to save a life. McFadden had never seen anyone look as bad as the woman lying motionless in the bottom of the raft. He gave little notice to the short man wearing sunglasses who was standing idly next to him. "Give me some help," McFadden said, and then together the sunglasses man and someone else, McFadden never knew who it was, helped him lift the inert weight of the blonde woman out of the raft and onto the sand. The woman was in imminent danger of death, if not already dead, McFadden realized. "This is it," he thought. "When they're blue like that, that means they're cyanotic, no oxygen." "What happened?" McFadden asked the man with the sunglasses while he checked the victim for breathing and a pulse. He couldn't find either.
She was underwater, the man said. She swallowed some water.
McFadden tilted the woman's head back, checked her airway, pinched her nostrils shut, and began blowing air down her throat.
How long was she under?
He asked between breaths.
10 minutes, the man offered.
After 2 breaths, the woman threw up. The fluid was reddish and sticky. McFadden thought perhaps it might be blood. A crowd started gathering.
Oh, God, I'm going to have to save this woman's life, McFadden thought.
I'm a paramedic. Let me help, came the voice of a nearby woman. McFadden gladly gave up his place at the dying woman's mouth to Patty Schultz. Schultz pinched the woman's nostrils shut and took over the breathing while McFadden started vigorous compressions on the dying woman's chest, trying to get her heart started again. The man with the sunglasses squatted quietly on his heels at her feet, watching their efforts impassively. In between breaths, Schultz puffed questions.
How long was she under? She asked.
Breath. The man in the sunglasses shook his head. I don't know.
Was it 5 minutes?
Breath.
I don't know.
Was it 10?
Breath.
20?
Breath.
The man just kept shaking his head. McFadden and Schultz stripped away the top of the woman's black, red, and yellow bathing suit. Schultz saw that her stomach was distended. She'd obviously swallowed a large amount of water. Every few seconds, more water came up, so she and McFadden kept rolling the woman onto her side to empty the fluid. Sand stuck to her face. Sirens sounded in the distance. Schultz kept breathing, and McFadden kept pushing. There was no response from the woman.
Breath. Push. Breath. Push.
The man in the sunglasses watched them, without expression or comment. A rescue van braked to a stop a short distance away. Uniformed paramedics ran up with resuscitation equipment. McFadden and Schultz stood back to let them in. One of the uniformed rescuers shoved a stainless steel tube down the dying woman's throat and coupled it to the breathing equipment. He started an intravenous line. He administered a heart stimulant. He monitored his instruments. He thrust a defibrillator paddle under the woman, laid its mate on her chest, and gave the woman's heart a jolt. Again. Again. A fourth time. Nothing. No breathing, no pulse. As he worked, he too noticed the man in the sunglasses squatting placidly at the woman's feet.
"Who are you?" the new paramedic asked.
"I'm her husband," the man told him.
2. Roth. Tyson and Riley Baumgartner stood among the gawkers, watching people pound on their mother and roll her about on the sand as the efforts to save her life grew increasingly frantic and violent. Lifeguard Kelly Kroll saw them standing at the edge of the crowd, clearly upset. Someone was holding up beach blankets to conceal the life-saving effort from the rubberneckers.
"Are you okay?" asked Kroll, not knowing who they were.
"That's our mom," said Tyson, nodding at the activity.
Kroll took them by their hands.
"Oh, I'm so sorry," Kroll said. "Come with me. You don't need to stand here and watch this. You come with me and we're going to go up to the guard shack."
As they went to the lifeguard office, Kroll asked Tyson and Riley for their names and ages. The two boys looked alike, neat and clean, sturdily built, with light brown hair. They could have been anyone's idea of normal, healthy, happy kids, except for the fact that they had just been watching their mother die.
"Is there anyone I can call for you? Your dad?"
"That's our dad down there," Tyson told Kroll. Tyson was obviously referring to the man in the sunglasses. Kroll was flabbergasted. She thought the man squatting at the drowned woman's feet was probably a stranger, someone who had found the woman floating in the lake and had done the responsible thing by rowing her into shore. The man sitting by the woman seemed so remote, so uninvolved with what was going on.
"What's your dad's name?" Kroll asked.
"Randy," Tyson told her. "Randy Roth." Kroll pictured the man she'd seen next to the dying woman. He was short, maybe 5'8 or so, but very well built, quite muscular, actually, and attractive. His weight might have been around 160 to 170 pounds. He looked like he was in his mid-30s or so.
He had dark hair, not overlong, and a thick, neatly trimmed mustache. He was shirtless and wearing shorts and rubber beach sandals along with the sunglasses. The most noticeable thing about the man was his utter lack of demonstrativeness while his wife's life was ebbing away. He had said nothing, showed no signs of agitation or anxiety. Kroll now saw him in a different light. She guessed the man was in severe shock. Actually, Tyson continued, Randy was really their stepfather. Their own father had died years before, and their mother married Randy only a year ago. After the marriage, Randy and their mother bought a new house in a new neighborhood, and they had all moved in together along with Randy's son, Greg. Now they were worried Randy might lose track of them and go to the hospital without them, stranding them at the beach. Kroll told the boys she would tell their stepfather where they were if they promised to stay at the lifeguard office. The boys said they would, so Kroll set off to talk with Randy Roth. While Kroll was walking back down the beach, Randy Roth suddenly stood up and walked over to his raft. Several people in the crowd of onlookers saw him remove several soaking wet plastic tote bags and empty a considerable amount of water from the bottom of the craft. Then he opened the raft's air valves. The paramedics continued to call out to each other and back to their base on their radio. Police arrived. Motorcycle officers pushed the crowd back, and another officer produced a notebook and started assembling the facts. He noticed the dark-haired man with a mustache deflating the raft. Because the man was only a few feet from the life-saving work, the police officer told him to get out of the way. "I'm her husband," Randy said, pressing on the raft's air chambers to force the deflation. "You're her husband?" Officer Randall G. Cox was taken aback. Until that moment, Cox had assumed no one present knew who the woman was. He'd been trying to figure out a way to identify her. Now this. It was weird. Whoever this guy was, he sure wasn't acting like anybody involved. "I'm her husband," Randy repeated. Cox covered his surprise by pressing the man for the details, like the victim's name. "Cindy," Randy said. "Well, Cynthia. Roth." Randy wasn't looking directly at Cox. He continued pushing the air out of the raft. Cox got Randy's own name, address, and phone number. "What boat were you in?" "This one," Randy said as he pushed the last of the air out. His actions were beginning to bother Cox. "Maybe you shouldn't be deflating it," Cox suggested. "Well, I have to get ready to go." "Tell me what happened," said Cox. "Well, we were paddling around the lake," Randy said, finally looking directly at Cox. "We were swimming around out there, and she got a cramp in her leg. She was hanging on the side of the raft, and then a boat went by and swamped us. That was when the raft flipped over. I heard her choke like she swallowed some water. I turned the raft over, and I found her floating face down. I tried to get her back into the raft, and I did, and then I just paddled in to get help." Randy's tone made it all sound so matter-of-fact. He might as well have been talking about an everyday event. "Where are you going to take her?" he asked. "Overlake Hospital," Cox told him. "We'll give you an escort," Cox said. "No, that's okay," Randy said. "I've been there before." He began rolling the raft up. One of the onlookers in the crowd who had been watching Randy closely for some minutes now took Cox aside. "I don't think he should be driving any place right now," Alicia Tracy told Cox. "I think this man must be in shock. He's just so devoid of anything." Tracy thought the enormity of the event might hit the man while he was driving to the hospital. Roth might have a bad accident when the reaction set in. Cox thought so, too. It just wasn't human to be so distant, especially in the midst of a personal tragedy. Who knew when Roth might go off? "This guy is sitting on the edge of an emotional explosion," Cox thought. "Well, I think we'll give him a ride," he told Tracy. "No, no, you don't understand," Randy said when the police offered him a ride to the hospital a second time. "I have my truck here. I have to drive my truck over." The police persisted. "Well, we'll bring you back to your truck," Cox said. "No, I've got all my stuff here, and I've got two kids somewhere here on the beach." Then Randy rose, shouldered the deflated raft, picked up two of the bags, and walked toward the parking lot some 200 yards away. Tracy and Cox stared after him.
"What do you mean you have two children here on the beach?" Tracy thought. "You have been sitting over there this whole time, rolling up your raft, and you have two children over here watching their mother die?"
Now Tracy wasn't sure Randy was in shock after all. As Randy strode away, Patty Schultz grabbed the two remaining tote bags and went after him. She, too, was concerned that he might be in shock. She told him she would be happy to drive him to the hospital. Randy again refused.
"Well, at least let me ride with you."
Randy ignored her and walked off toward his truck. Schultz followed him. As they neared the parking lot, Kelly Kroll caught up with him.
"I've got your kids," she said.
But it seemed like Randy didn't hear her. Kroll followed, trying to get his attention. A fire department official also gave chase, wanting more information for his report. Randy ignored everyone as he made for his truck. The fire official finally got Randy to slow down. He asked him what had happened on the lake. How did the accident happen? Randy explained again about the boat and the raft capsizing. "I turned over the raft," he said, "and she was dead."
"Dead?"
The fire official was incredulous.
"Well, unconscious," Randy said.
Kroll trotted back to the lifeguard station and got the two boys. They ran after Randy, sobbing. Randy stopped. He took the wet tote bags from Schultz and gave them to Tyson and Riley to carry. Schultz got the impression that Randy was disgusted with the boys for weeping.
"Come on, boys, we're going to the hospital," he said.
Tyson and Riley took the sacks and choked back their sobs. Randy's behavior seemed increasingly surreal to Tracy and several other onlookers in the crowd. Tracy couldn't believe that he had simply ignored the two boys throughout the entire life-saving ordeal.
"He hasn't said a word to them," she thought.
"He hasn't gone over to them. He hasn't put his arms around them. He didn't drop all his things and run to them and cry. He has done absolutely nothing. Those little boys are terrified, and their daddy's not even giving them a hug." It made Tracy sick to her stomach to watch. Patty Schultz stopped Tyson and Riley before they could follow their stepfather.
"Hi, what are your names?" she asked, hugging both boys.
The boys started to cry again.
"Well, my name's Patty," Schultz said, "and I'm going to ride with you to the hospital."
Randy marched on toward the parking lot, carrying his rubber raft.
3. Too Calm. Mike Helbach had been a paramedic for more than a dozen years. In that time, he had seen plenty of people die. He also had seen their loved ones react as life slipped away, and never before had he seen someone as casual about death as Randy Roth. As Helbach hovered over the comatose Cindy Roth while the aid car screamed toward the hospital some 8 miles away, he kept thinking about the man with the sunglasses.
"Most people are frantic," Helbach thought. "Or if they aren't, they're almost rigid. Not that guy. For Pete's sake, that guy was practically nonchalant."
The doctors at the hospital were on the radio. Helbach could tell from Cindy Roth's blue coloring that she hadn't had any air for at least 10 minutes before the resuscitation efforts began. The doctors kept asking Helbach what was wrong with the victim. They didn't understand how she could have drowned so close to a life raft. Was she diabetic? The doctors wanted to know. Did she have some sort of seizure?
"I don't know. I don't know," Helbach could only report.
"There's got to be some reason," the doctors told Helbach over the radio.
"I can't find anything," Helbach said.
Why hadn't Roth alerted a lifeguard earlier? Helbach couldn't believe he hadn't asked for help far sooner. Someone had told Helbach that Cindy was found face down in the water in the raft, that Randy had been swimming, and that he had pushed the raft to shore with Cindy in it. Helbach thought that meant that Randy had pushed the raft ahead of him while swimming toward shore, which Helbach thought was crazy. What's wrong with that guy anyway? About 10 minutes later, the aid car pulled up to the hospital's emergency entrance, and Cindy was hustled inside. Helbach got ready to write his report. "There's something wrong with this whole thing," Helbach thought. "The flavor of this call stinks." Randy turned his Isuzu Trooper onto the freeway to follow the paramedic van. Patty Schultz sat next to him in the front seat. Tyson and Riley sat in the back. The boys were still crying, but making an obvious effort to keep quiet. Schultz again had the impression that the kids were frightened of Randy, that Randy was a stern father who frowned on the kids showing any emotion. The boys said nothing. Schultz tried to talk to Randy, but Randy answered in monosyllables. Even when they turned onto the freeway, Schultz noticed that Randy was driving very slowly. She was watching him closely. "His affect was off," Schultz said later, referring to Randy's demeanor. "He didn't seem to be reacting at all. I didn't want him to have a reaction on the way in and endanger himself or his children." Randy asked Schultz how long a person could go without oxygen before irreversible brain damage and death. Schultz didn't want to tell Randy directly that Cindy was probably already dead, fearing that it might trigger the pent-up reaction she saw as inevitable. She tried to be gentle. "Well, the paramedics are giving her medication, which will hopefully start her heart again," Schultz told Randy. "They'll do more at the hospital. She's going to have very good care." "Well, how long, then?" Randy asked. Schultz thought she should give Randy some hope. "Oh, maybe 30 minutes, Schultz said, knowing she was telling a white lie. "After 30 minutes of CPR. Randy was silent for a minute. "What about without CPR?" he asked. Schultz admitted that it wouldn't be very long. Randy nodded. "I thought it was about 4 minutes before the brain stops," he said. "I remember that from the CPR class I took." Schultz said nothing to this, but was thinking, "If this guy knows CPR, why didn't he help his wife?" The scene at the beach upset another bystander far more than she had realized. After the aid car left, Maureen DeVink gathered up her children and her belongings and went straight home. She was still marveling over the man's lack of apparent reaction to his wife's probable death. She could still see Randy casually deflating and rolling up his raft while his wife was dying only a few feet away. "That was weird," DeVink thought. "You'd think he'd have been more interested in the condition of his wife than his boat, wouldn't you?" Maureen's husband was home from work when she arrived. She looked at her husband and immediately burst into tears. She imagined herself on the beach, with paramedics rolling her back and forth to empty her stomach of water, shoving tubes down her throat, and her own husband so seemingly indifferent to her plight. "Think about it," Maureen told her husband. "If they were doing CPR on me and I'm laying there and looking dead and there's no response, and they're flipping me back and forth and emptying my stomach, I just can't imagine you would sit at the end of my feet and act so unresponsive." He didn't ask, "Is she going to be okay?" He didn't even, you know, go, "My God, where's the ambulance?" It was really, really weird. That was when it hit Maureen. She was sure in her heart that the man had murdered his wife. "I think he killed her," Maureen told her husband and a neighbor who had come over. "Do you think I should call the police and tell him how I feel?" But Maureen's husband and the neighbor told her she was just suffering a reaction from the trauma of the events. "Oh, Rennie, there's such a large range of shock," the neighbor said. "I know, but it just seemed weird," Maureen insisted. Maureen's husband didn't think she should call the police. "Rennie, I'm sure that if that's the way he was acting, the police are going to catch on," he said. "If there's anything to it at all, the police are going to investigate." As it turned out, just as DeVink was having this conversation, the police were indeed preparing to investigate, and for exactly the reasons that DeVink had pinpointed. 4. Randy's Story. As Maureen DeVink sensed, Patty Schultz suspected, and Mike Helbach knew, Cindy Roth was beyond saving. Shortly after 6:30 p.m., the pretty young mother was declared dead. Tyson and Riley Baumgartner were orphans. Like most major hospitals, Overlake Hospital in Bellevue, Washington, employed a social worker to help family members cope with grief. Devorah Cost was with Randy and the boys when the doctors told them Cindy was gone. The boys were in heavy shock. Tears streamed down their faces. Neither said anything, and Randy said nothing to them. It seemed to Cost that the boys were in one world, Randy in another. It was hard to believe they were even related. Randy looked angry, Cost thought. He seemed very tight, almost sullen. Cost thought he was feeling defensive. He was still wearing his sunglasses. "I couldn't save her," he said several times to no one in particular. Officials from the county medical examiner's office arrived. Randy briefly described what happened at the lake. Then a detective from the Redmond Police Department came into the room, and Randy told the story again. "I'm not wearing these dark glasses to hide anything from you," Randy told him. The detective didn't say anything to that. Instead, he asked Randy to write a statement. Randy finished the statement a few minutes after 7 p.m. "We arrived at the lake approx 2:30 p.m., then needed to inflate the raft and inner tubes for the kids, so it was sometime after 3 o'clock when we reached the beach," Randy wrote. The two boys were going to float in the swim area as they had done with their mom before. Cindy asked me to row to the east side of the lake where it would be more romantic. I said it looks like a long way. She replied, "You're strong, you can do it." We rowed to the other side and paddled around a while and started back. She asked if I would like to cool off with a swim, and I said okay. We swam for about 10 minutes, and she said the cool water was giving her a cramp in her leg. I said, "Let's head back." We were at the side of the raft where she was holding on to the rope, and I said, "Hang on, I'll go around and hold the other side so you can get in." As I was working my way around, a wake from a passing boat about 50 to 100 yards away went by, and the raft turned over on top of her. She coughed once, and I hurried to right the raft, which took about 30 seconds. She was already floating face down, and I couldn't get her into the raft from the water. I managed to climb in and pulled her aboard, and proceeded to row to the beach side where help could be found. Upon beaching, a lifeguard was summoned by my son Tyson, who was on shore, and she started CPR. The man from the medical examiner's office told Randy an autopsy would have to be performed on Cindy. "I don't want one," Randy said. "Sorry," said the official, "there wasn't any choice in the matter. Under the law, any unexpected, unattended death required an autopsy." Now, Cost asked if she could call someone for them, and the boys said they wanted to talk to their grandparents, Cindy's mother and father. But Randy reminded them that Cindy's parents were visiting relatives in North Dakota and couldn't be reached. Randy said he would call Cindy's brother instead. Cost offered Randy some pamphlets on grief and counseling facilities. Randy took the handouts but didn't seem very interested in them. Just after 7:30 p.m., Randy and the boys left the hospital. At that point, the detective told Randy he wanted to impound the raft. Randy became very upset on hearing this, the detective later recalled, wanting to know why the police wanted it and saying the police had no right to take it. Cindy had been dead for less than an hour. Redmond Police Detective Larry Conrad thought Randy's behavior was highly unusual. As he looked over the written statement, Conrad couldn't help feeling that his description of the drowning just didn't sound right. The medical people were convinced that Cindy had been without oxygen for a substantial period of time. Why hadn't Randy called for help? There were scores of boats on the lake. Why hadn't he waved to any of them? Anyway, could a wake from a powerboat really have flipped the raft over? But most of all, there was Randy's demeanor. Calmly deflating the raft while his wife lay dying seemed peculiar, to say the least. And there was Randy's opposition to an autopsy. Further, when Conrad thought about Randy's story, he was struck by the fact that all of the fateful decisions seemed to have been made by the dead woman. It was her idea to go to the lake. It was her idea to row to the other shore. It was her idea to go swimming. Randy made himself sound powerless, helpless, a mere hapless bystander. He hadn't comforted the boys. He hadn't cried himself. Instead, he appeared focused on mundane, pragmatic, mechanical tasks. To Conrad, the picture simply had too many broken pieces. Conrad called his sergeant and filled him in. The sergeant agreed something might be fishy about Randy Roth and the death of his wife of less than 1 year. But if anything criminal had befallen Cindy Roth, it hadn't taken place inside the city of Redmond, the sergeant pointed out. The city's jurisdiction ended.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?